Welcome to another episode of the Young Turks. I'm John Iderola, joined by Michael Shore and Mark Thompson. Thanks, guys, for returning. And today's a special day, you know, not just because you guys are here. That's awesome. But on top of that, this is kind of inside baseball. And I hope that a lot of the people who've been watching the show for the past few months won't even know why this is a big day. But today we marked 200 shows starting on time.
Oh, they'll know. They know it's a big day.
Well, no, but people who haven't been watching for a long time might not know. They might be like, yeah, you're supposed to start on time, which is true. I'll grant you that. But we did not. I mean, there was years where we would start 5, 10, 15 minutes late. And it took a monstrous effort with a few restarts where we, you know.
Well, there's also an asterisk, which is that Cenk Uygur wasn't here for 173 of those days.
That is true.
There was a bit of an assist there.
Cenk does slow the process down.
A little bit. But yeah, so we want you guys to be able to rely on us to be here when we're supposed to be here. And so we've been trying, both us, but more importantly, the people behind the cameras who make sure we're here and broadcasting. And so this marks 200 shows. And so I just wanted to acknowledge that. I don't know if you can hear that. But anyway, we do have a big show. This week has a theme, and that is the fight to stop the AHCA. This show has a theme, and that is the brewing corruption, both inside of the Trump family and also in their business associates. And we have a couple of stories we want to do today concerning those. Anything we need to get to before we jump into the stories?
Anything you want to talk about? Megyn Kelly having Alex Jones on her show.
It's just obscene.
It's pathetic.
I get it. I mean, I get why they say
it's a ratings grab.
It's a ratings grab. She needs it, apparently, you know, Sunday night on MSNBC. And I don't necessarily think it means an endorsement, but it's Father's Day.
Right. Oh, wow, you're right. I thought it was obscene before I remembered it was Father's Day.
And think about not just this guy who says Sandy Hook was a hoax, but also the
fact that
he has all this paternity background to him and deadbeat dadness to him. He's a clown, and it's too bad. And they probably would get just as much traction by canceling it and then
airing
it, right?
Yeah.
No?
Mark?
Yeah.
They'd get it. When you say traction, they'd get impact by canceling him, but they wouldn't get tune in by and he's, I mean, that's all they're doing. This is, you know, it's kind of good that you mention it, because it's a great reminder that when we watch all these different networks, they're only motivated by the dollar. They're only motivated by making a buck. And that's why they book Alex Jones. So they don't. They get headlines by canceling Alex Jones, but they don't get the tune in and the dollars that they want associated with
it. Well, that's true. But there's something provocative about it too, right? I mean, isn't he somebody that I'm being devil's advocate here. If you're sitting at NBC, you're saying, hey, we got Alex Jones. He's coming on, he's talking to us. I don't know how tough a get he is, but I mean, he's certainly somebody people talk about. And that interview would get-
I assume he was enthusiastic.
I don't think he's a tough get at all.
I don't think so. So there's a viral element to it that could happen to
about
this show.
And that's what she's hoping for. He brings his own viral element. It doesn't have to do with clicks. It's pathetic. It's pathetic whether it was her idea or whether MSNBC forced it on her. It doesn't matter. It's pathetic. I mean, her defenders are going to say, well, look, she was really hard on him. It doesn't matter. People like that just want you to see their face. They just want to scream at the camera for a few minutes. It doesn't matter if you show point by point how wrong they are. Their mission is accomplished the second the camera starts rolling. And she is smart enough to know that. For all of her own problems, she knows what she's doing. And I don't think that she should be participating in this.
Yeah, I agree. They got to cancel that.
Yeah. Okay, now let's turn to some domestic news. It's incredibly likely that this week will be the beginning of the end for either Obamacare or Trumpcare. Cloaked in secrecy with effectively no debate whatsoever, Republican senators are working to push through the AHCA as quickly as possible. They're going to advance it, they're going to vote on it, and you will know effectively nothing about what the Senate version of the AHCA is until the vote actually happens. Unless we do something to stop that. And so that is going to be the theme on today's show and throughout this week. Now, I want to give a little bit of credit to Claire McCaskill late last week talking with Orrin Hatch over this secrecy. I think that she could have gone a little bit harder, but she is actually bringing up the issue. So let's play this video and then discuss.
Will we have a hearing on the healthcare proposal?
Will we?
Yes.
I think we've already had one, but...
No, I mean on the proposal that you're planning to bring to the floor of the Senate for a vote. Will there be a hearing?
What do you... Well, I don't know that there's going to be another hearing, but we've invited you to...
Can you say that you're inviting us, and I heard you, Mr. Secretary, just say we'd love your support. For what? We don't even know. We have no idea what's being proposed. There's a group of guys in a back room somewhere that are making these decisions. There were no hearings in the House. I mean, listen, this is hard to take. Well, you couldn't have a more partisan exercise than what you're engaged in right now. We're not even going to have a hearing on a bill that impacts 1/6 of our economy. We're not going to have an opportunity to offer a single amendment. It is all being done with an eye to try to get it by with 50 votes and the vice president. I am stunned that that is what Leader McConnell would call regular order, which he sanctimoniously said would be the order of the day when the Republicans took the Senate over. We are now so far from regular order, the new members don't even know what it looks like.
And if you're coming up as an American trying to understand American politics in the past couple of years, I don't think anyone knows what regular order looks like on a wider sense. But yeah, he was fed a line. He asked for someone to tell him what to say there. Now he's not the problem at the end of the day. It's all of them.
He's
all
the problem
of them
at
together.
The beginning of the day.
He's the problem at the beginning of the show, certainly. And he is part of the problem. But I love this idea that we already had a hearing. You had a hearing. First of all, I don't remember that hearing, and I don't believe that there was a hearing.
But it wasn't
in the House
about this bill.
But yeah, but even if they had had it, even if he wasn't lying there, I mean. Do you guys remember when they were debating Obamacare? From the beginning of the debating to the bill actually being passed, I think 3 Fast and Furious movies came out. That's how long it was, how many hearings there were, how many amendments there were, just constantly trying to get Republicans to sign on to it. Here he's like, well, we already spoke once, why would we do it again? So 20 or 30 million Americans are gonna lose their health insurance. Maybe 30,000 Americans are gonna die unnecessarily every single year. Are we gonna talk twice about this? No. And so that's absurd. Now that's their defense, but we're gonna talk a little bit procedurally how they're trying to advance this more quickly. But we do know that this is not just Orrin Hatch's position, this is the default position of the Republicans in the Senate. They're not going to make this clear until at least after the CBO scores it. Senate GOP aides said this, we aren't stupid, we're still in discussions about what will be in the final product, so it is premature to release any draft absent further member conversations and consensus. Members there being Republicans, since the Democrats don't even know what's in the bill. And one of the reasons they're not stupid, I guess, and don't want this to be discussed is summed up in this poll from Quinnipiac showing the approval rating for the HCA is at 17%. Making Donald Trump look like Justin Bieber. That's an old reference. I don't even know if he's that popular anymore. But it's not popular, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things there. First of all, you know, he said we're not stupid because they know exactly what they're doing. They're trying to go the roundabout route with this and get something through without very many people being a part of it. So that's what they're saying, they're not stupid. We're not stupid politically.
That
just explains. I mean, implicit in that is that they know exactly what they're doing because they are not stupid and they are going to try and force feed this. The one thing about which to be somewhat encouraged is that there aren't any sort of nationally ambitious or aggressive Republicans on the Senate side who are going to run with this and run as people who think that that by supporting it they need to appeal to Republicans and by opposing it they wound themselves. Bill Cassidy of Louisiana is one to watch, and a lot of the moderates have been kind of, you know, a little bit dull on this, a little bit saying, hey, you know, I don't know that we should go ahead with this. And now you see them starting to speak a different language about it. Mm-hmm. Dean Heller of Nevada, you've been to Nevada, Mark. Dean Heller is somebody who's up for re-election next year what is a blue state, and he's a Republican. He has a lot to do with what happens with this. So coming out of that, I mean, this isn't a done deal, but it's still so discouraging to see the process go in the direction that it's gone on this, because they're not going through regular order, like you said, John, and they are not telling people what's in this bill.
You talk about GOP, though, attaching themselves to this. I mean, there is not a lot of political capital to be gained by being associated with this bill if
right.
you're a member of the GOP. So I'd be surprised if it, you know, it should have some 10-foot pole marks all over it, because
which it did as recently as last week. Mm-hmm. And right now you start hearing people who are moderate, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, speaking just kind of, you know, a little bit more carefully. Yeah. Well, maybe it's a little better than it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there are those people that are, we don't know for sure if they will support it or not. I mean, it being at 17% and not, I mean, there are policies that could theoretically be at 17% approval that they would still pass, but
like the war in Iraq.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But particularly salient when the topic that's so unpopular theoretically will strip your own constituents of their health care and leave their families destitute and their businesses bankrupt. I think that will have an effect. And we're going to return to those people in the middle that might be swayed in just a second. But I want to talk again procedurally. How are they working on this? Last week, McConnell deployed Rule 14, a fast track procedure that bypasses the committee process and moves the bill directly to the floor. Just as in the House, we're on track to have a vote with no hearings when there were more than 100 for the ACA. So just in case Orrin Hatch is watching, they didn't have just two, by the way. Knowing the coverage loss will be significant, McConnell plans to vote within only days or possibly even hours of the release of the CBO score. And before and after the CBO will be discredited by the Republicans as much as possible, possibly shut down. I've heard that bandied about as well. And so they're not even going to bother with the whole committee procedure, going through that step. They're going to pass it immediately to the House, or to the floor, I should say. And they're hoping that they get the score, they vote on it, maybe a basketball game is on or something, and they can just slip it through and they don't have to worry anymore. And that could come within the next couple of weeks, theoretically.
Yeah, and they also have the White House behind it, too. Mm-hmm. And so the White House doing all of whatever it is they're doing, trying to get some positive news, trying to get, you know, the president's been between 34 and 38% in approval ratings, not just Quinnipiac, which, by the way, you're from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Quinnipiac is in Hamden, Connecticut. You have to be able to say Quinnipiac better. It's been like 7 years of you saying Quinnipiac.
I was fairly certain that I was saying it correctly.
I don't think you were.
The only direct experience I have with it other than polling is that I played a tennis tournament there once.
Of course, when you were in Bridgeport and they were in Hamden.
Yeah.
And
yes.
You know, you probably said it wrong then too. But the point
more
is
than likely.
That these that the White House is looking for, and the Republicans want to change that tide because they need to be able to say something's going on that isn't Russia, that isn't Jared Kushner, that isn't the hearings and the special counsel. And so they need this too.
Yeah.
And the White House is giving them a lot of leeway.
They need to show that they can do something. Right now, the story is, look, they've got control of everything and they can't get anything done. This may be the wrong, I think, clearly you're right. At the end of it all, they just want to say, hey, look, and we got this passed. You know, we undid that awful Obamacare. I just don't know. Once the dust settles, and they're keeping it dusty, so it may not settle for a while, what we're really going to be left with. I mean, that is to say, whether they're going to be left with anything they can be proud of, might be another way to put it.
Yeah. Well, as a country, we certainly won't be left with anything to be proud of.
Right. Also, the things that make them proud, by the way, are not necessarily
that's a good point.
It's a benchmark.
They'll build talking points about around whatever comes out.
Yeah. Exactly. And we're not going to go through all the stats again. We've done it dozens of times over the course of the past year. But I mean, there's perhaps, other than maybe climate change related issues or maybe the tax code, I don't know if there's a more consequential thing that the Republicans are going to attempt to do during this first term in terms of the impact on American families' lives, welfare, and their actual wealth as well. I mean, the numbers are stark. If you're talking about the numbers of hundreds of billions of dollars of effective tax giveaways that are going to go to the richest Americans, the number of Americans who are going to lose health insurance, the effect is dire. You already know that, so we're not going to go through it again. But we do want to give you something you can do with this. And it's a fairly old school political thing, but here I do think that it could have some effect. So if we could bring up this lower third here, it's a very simple thing. I want you to get your phone. If we can bring up the lower third, the final graphic. So that's the switchboard at the US Capitol where you can talk to, you can try to get to at least the office of your senator. And they are going to have an aide who's working in particular on their healthcare policy. And you have got to call in and you've got to make yourself heard. Because as Michael was saying, there are some Republican senators who are rightfully horrified about what effect voting for this might have on their electoral prospects the next time around. Some of them are up in just a year and a half. Those people can theoretically be persuaded. And while it seems ridiculous in this time that they would actually care about people calling into their offices, everything I've read leads me to believe that they do still actually pay attention to that.
Well, look, Capitol Hill is trapped. These guys are back. They're turning the Wayback Machine to 1950. Believe me, the phone ringing off the hook matters to these guys. They don't know of texting.
Yes.
I mean, really, right. The guys deciding on this are a bunch of old white guys in Washington. So, yeah, ring those phones. Yeah.
And we only have two old white guys on this panel, so that's, that makes a big difference.
I'm working on it. All give right. me some time. Okay, but that is something that you can do, and we will continue to track this throughout this week and let you know what they're doing to try to advance this. But let's turn to something slightly different as soon as I find it. Okay. A day of protests across Russia has turned into a series of mass arrests, beginning with the detainment of a prominent Putin critic named Alexei Navalny. Navalny's wife, Yulia, said on his Twitter feed that he was arrested about a half hour before the Moscow demonstration that he was going to attend was to begin. Police later confirmed the arrest, saying he could get up to 15 days in jail on charges of failing to follow police orders and violating public order. Well, we now know he didn't get up to 15 days. He got 30 days in jail for some sort of crimes about organizing. So he was one of the critics of Putin who organized these mass demonstrations across the country. And you will be shocked to find out that if you are a critic of Putin, bad things can happen to you. 30 days in jail, a fairly light consequence for his activism.
Yeah, especially, Navalny is not just a critic of Putin. His main issue is corruption.
Is corruption, yes, specifically, so, and he's very vocal about it.
So you're going to go after Putin for corruption? That's really hitting him right.
Exactly, exactly. And so what you're seeing there is not Navalny's arrests. But you're seeing possibly up to 1,000 arrests across Russia throughout today. As of early evening, nearly 700 people had been detained in Moscow alone, as many as 900 in St. Petersburg, according to rights groups. Police even admit 650 detentions in just those two cities, and smaller numbers of protesters being detained across the country. There were permits for up to 190 separate marches. Now, this follows an earlier, back in March, an absolutely massive series of demonstrations against Putin. Now, that had an electoral component and also a corruption component as well. There is going to be elections in the relatively near future in Russia. Putin theoretically could receive an additional 6 years as the leader of that country, which just boggles the mind. But that is a possibility. And someone like Navalny, being one of the opposition figures who hasn't yet been assassinated, says that he is going to stand in that election. And he has been charged with any number of different crimes of embezzlement and all of these things. He's been sentenced to 5 years of hard labor before. Thankfully, there was an outcry from rights groups and that was vacated. He was released after being arrested. But this is just another in a long series of detainments and arbitrary arrests. When I was in Oslo, I reported on a prominent theater director in Moscow had been arrested, as well as 50 of his associates for breaking some sort of morality code in the arts. It's a gigantic mess there, but it is heartening to see so many Russians, especially the sorts of young Russians that follow Navalny, continuing to protest, even though that scene that you're seeing there, that's not new or surprising to them. They've seen this before.
That's a great point, John. I mean, the idea that you're swimming upstream against that kind of current of violence against protesters. Mm-hmm. And, it's the Wild West out there. The cops can do whatever they want. The riot police beat up a lot of people. They detain and arrest even more. And you end up with a situation that is designed to discourage participation in the system. It's designed to discourage protest. And then John also rightly said, ultimately, the leaders of these movements are eliminated. I mean, literally off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
So it's a courageous move beyond the normal courage that we see for people to take to the streets of Russia.
And they're trying to stop them from even being able to take to the streets, not just what they do to them when they do. They're trying to prevent that organization, which is, you know, that's what the, I think the, whoever is the head of police there is saying, that they want to prevent it entirely. You brought up Oslo and a theater director. Did you know that the play Oslo won the Tony Award for best play last night?
So, I did not know
that. It all comes full circle.
Oh, yeah. Small world, surprising. but yeah, and look, Navalny, in April of this year, was ambushed on the street and had this substance thrown into his face that dyed his face. Thankfully, it did not kill him. He apparently has lost the vast majority of his sight in his right eye. But that is, this is the danger in standing up to a regime like Putin's, is that theoretically that could just be the beginning. I apologize, I'm forgetting the name of the opposition figure who was poisoned and nearly killed several years ago, was poisoned again, I believe, in the last year.
Viktor Yushchenko.
Yushchenko, yes. So he spoke in Oslo while I was there and has twice attempted assassinations against him. They also had the daughter of Boris Nemtsov, who was gunned down outside of the government building in Moscow. I mean, this is an incredibly dangerous thing for regular people attempting to exercise their political rights, and for those who will stand as leaders for that movement. I hope that they release as many of these people as possible. I don't think that if this is an attempt to shut down the protest, to try to cut, to hamstring the movement, it doesn't seem likely to work considering the sorts of people we saw in that video. Anyway, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, we're going to turn back to America and back to the corruption that's taking over our government. Trump personally enriching himself and his business associates. We're going to break that down when we come back from this break.
Joking, I just hate that small group.
Anyway, so we are back on the Young Turks. Welcome to the rest of the first hour with me, John. Michael Shore is here. Mark Thompson as well. Cenk is still out. I have no idea what country he's in. I'm going to keep it real. But we do have some tweets.
I know what country he's in.
Where is he? Are we allowed to say? Probably for the best we don't.
Let's not say.
Okay, let's not do it.
It's a country.
We're going to
Cenk.
We're going to poll you guys. It's a game of where in the world is Cenk Uygur? But anyway, we're going to read some tweets that you sent in. Peter Giel wrote, "Man, I didn't expect you to start on time. Missed the beginning."
See, that's a long time TYT viewer.
I don't think you.
That's a 201 day old tweet.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. Referring back to the Trump Care story, Dr. Chaos MD, who has my favorite name. "If your aide has to spoon feed you your entire response to a simple question, you can't even say that. Time to retire."
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I agree.
You have to work extra hard to make John McCain look with it in the past week.
Who said that?
No, I just didn't.
Oh, you said that?
My observation.
Oh, wow.
By the way, Orrin Hatch, fourth in line to the presidency.
I love it.
If something happened to Pence and Ryan and our president, our president would be Orrin Hatch.
Wow. Yes. So thank you for those tweets. I want to recognize the members. It looks like it has been updated. Two of the members, Roberto Ivan and William Mazuka, thank you for being members and supporting us. And let's talk about something that members can see. Actually, over the past weekend, TYT attended the People's Summit in Chicago, and we have an exclusive look into the conference available for TYT members only on the website tytnetwork.com. So those two members can already see it. If you're not a member, you can fix that by going to tytnetwork.com/join, signing up, and you'll have access to that.
Tell us what the People's Summit is, John.
So the People's Summit was, I would say, an opportunity to once again hear Bernie Sanders give an awesome hour-long speech. But it was a gathering of up-and-coming politicians, activists, enthusiasts, and all that from around the country.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Watch it.
And so we released tons of videos from it already, but this we also have this extra for the members, so that's something to look forward to. But let's move on to the next story. Last week in DC, it was Infrastructure Week. Not really, but they wanted it to be. It was really Comey Week. I don't think they got that memo.
That's what Comey was talking about the whole time.
Exactly.
Right? Infrastructure.
It was something about pipes. But no, Trump wanted it to be Infrastructure Week. He had his plan for infrastructure, and so the way things normally go on TYT, I would go through that plan and I'd make a bunch of graphics, breaking down all the specifics, the stats, the quotes, and all that. I can't actually do that because there is no plan. There are no details. And despite the fact that they wanted a whole week to be named after this, we know almost nothing. At least with Shark Week, there's multiple shows you can watch. They actually have something. We only know one thing about his plan, but even just that is enough to know what their goal here is.
That it's gonna be the best plan ever?
It's gonna be be the best plan ever. I have two things then. Okay. That's true. But Robert Reich had an awesome breakdown of this. One of the interesting details, it would commit $200 billion of federal funding over 10 years. But more importantly, it would be combined with about $800 billion of assorted tax breaks to get developers to build things instead of the federal government doing it.
That's weird. A president who is a supposedly, presumably wealthy developer is going to get projects for developers. That's just
weird.
Strange.
By the way,
stuff.
Just as an aside, all those roads and bridges that you've seen that really were in pretty good shape when they were first built, but now have kind of fallen into disrepair, they were built by the government, weren't they?
Yeah, many of them were.
It's not as though I know we go, well, the government will screw it up. Well, we have one of the best highway systems in the world, and it was built by the government, and it gave a lot of people jobs. So didn't mean to get off ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, look, that was all well and good, but let's give Eric Trump a chance, see what he can build. Yeah. So that is the goal there. So for every dollar developers put into a project, they'd actually pay only about 18 cents after tax credits. Taxpayers would contribute about 82 cents through their tax dollars. Now, look, our case could be made there that theoretically, if the government was doing it themselves, taxpayers would be paying for that too, right? And so you might say, well, what's the difference if you pay the government or you pay the developers? Well, there is a big difference because the way they're gonna do it, the public would actually pay a second time as well. The developers would in the end own the roads and bridges and other pieces of infrastructure they finance. They then, of course, charge members of the public tolls and fees to use them. So rather than all of us contributing as a country, as a society, and then benefiting from those roads and bridges and pipes and all of that, we would instead subsidize private contractors to build and then own and then fine and toll your ass off into the rest of time.
I'm sure there'd be an open and transparent bidding process to who gets those, who gets the gig to rebuild the bridge and the road, like there are when governments and departments of transportation on state by state basis put them out right now to bid. It's a disaster. This is a scam. This is entirely untenable. The notion that they would then be responsible for and own these structures is so contrary to the way it ever worked, and it shouldn't. And
but it's so consistent with this whole Trump administration. The fact that the selling of America has, which we've always seen on some level, but it's sort of so naked now, right? He's really selling these projects to his buddies, to his billionaire contractor pals. And as you see them leasing public lands for mineral exploits and for petroleum drilling, that's the same thing. It's the selling of America.
But also where it's not broken, right? I mean, that's the other part. What you just, going off what you just said, Mark, we've been driving over these bridges and going through these tunnels and roads up for, decades and decades and decades. And guess what? They're breaking down, not because of how they were made. They were made really, really well, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what you do again, and that's the way it works. And so privatizing it is only going to get, and look, I mean, you say privatizing, look at the air traffic control. Air safety in America is extraordinarily good, right? U.S. Commercial air traffic is unbelievable the way they work. Now Trump wants to privatize it. There are problems with it, but this guy thinks that a problem is only solved by getting someone else rich and by privatizing an industry. That's what he wants to do with infrastructure. He wants to do with the air traffic controllers. It's a reflex. It's a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
And just as an aside, the maintenance of the roads, which is really what we need. A lot of this stuff just needs sort of something that's deferred maintenance is what's happened.
Do it with private prisoners.
They don't. There's not enough as much money in that. They're going to want to build new roads. Their new construction is where the money is for these guys. So it doesn't even address the real needs of this country.
Yeah, and look, maybe there are some places where theoretically they could do some sort of major development, like an area. Like I know Austin's highway system absolutely sucks. It cannot accommodate the number of people there. So theoretically, maybe you need some additional roads or something like that. But a lot of these bridges and roads, like you say, just need to be maintained. But if you have a private contractor do it, then they can spend a little bit of money. It's already built, okay? The vast majority of the work is already done, except that they get to turn it over to a toll road. And we've had this problem for a while in America where, look, some states and local governments desperately need money. And so they, you know, they bond out these roads and stuff like that. They give them these 50, 100 year leases on these private roads. But a lot of the times it's just short-sighted or it's local or state level corruption, but it's been haphazard and slow. This takes out all, you could just in one fell swoop, you can do that to the entire country. Have you lived in an area where a road has been converted over to tolls? It's horrible, especially in California where you don't even actually pay. You have to remember to go on a website and pay right later on, which is absolutely horrendous. That's a tangent perhaps.
No, it's not a tangent. That's accurate because who's getting the penalty money? Who's
exactly
getting,
you know, yeah, they so want you to forget exactly, so they can charge sure you even more.
So it's not a tangent at all. It's part of the same kind of scam that everybody's falling for. And if production and productivity, not production, is one of the aims of America, right, to moving America forward, making it great again. What does this do? It sends the rich people on the roads or the people that want to pay to get out of it, not just rich people, on the toll roads. And then the traffic is complicated on all other roads. Yeah. So the expeditious moving from point A to point B is harmed, but people are making money. It sounds like a sort of a basic argument, but it's actually true. It was borne out here in California that the traffic increased on the roads that didn't have the tolls, where they thought it was going to separate it and make people move yeah faster. It's not. It's a bad, bad thing.
Yeah, and so I'm glad that you brought up the class component, because of course we can't miss that. If you have just raw tax money pay for the maintenance, then theoretically a person who's paying a lot more in taxes is paying a greater absolute amount of money. But if you instead subsidize it by each individual human paying every time they use this, then that's inherently regressive. And the people who, the huge amount of poor or middle class Americans who have to use those roads every day just to get to work and home, they are going to be paying a larger percentage of their income than having the rich contribute in the way we've always expected in America's past. Okay, let's turn to there we have the wide swath of corruption. We want to look at one particular example of what we were just talking about.
More infrastructure.
A little bit more infrastructure. The FBI is currently looking for to build a new headquarters and a campus in DC. And the FBI is gigantic. It has a lot, thousands of employees are going to be there. So this is a big development. It's expected that it's going to be one of the biggest building related government contracts in US history, estimated to start off with a price tag of $2 billion. And we know how these things work out after a few years or after a decade, not to mention, of course, running the thing. And the contractor who's going to build the new one gets to control the previous one, which is an amazingly valuable piece of real estate. So who gets this contract is incredibly important, very lucrative. So let's check in on who might get this. Here's a surprise for you. Vornado Realty Trust, a New York real estate firm whose founder and chairman, Stephen Roth, is a longtime friend of and occasional advisor to Donald Trump, is one of three finalists for the rights to develop the FBI's new headquarters and campus. Now, you might have seen him in the news recently. Roth is helping head up Trump's Infrastructure Advisory Council, from which we have so many details, and traveled with the president as he rolled out his plans last week. Trump introduced him to the crowd as one of the greatest builders in America. I don't know if that's true, but he might soon be one of the richest builders in America if Donald Trump, whose administration will be making this choice, decides to go with him.
Is there any president who is more deserving of overseeing the groundbreaking of a new FBI headquarters than Donald Trump? I can't think of who that would be. Stephen Roth, already one of the biggest, richest builders in America, mm-hmm, as we speak. CREW, the Center for Research for Ethics and Politics, Responsible Ethics in Washington, the Ethics Watchdog, has said that there's no chance that this would pass any kind of muster, that mm-hmm. having Roth win this bid. And I think, I mean, well, of course he'll win it, right? But you would think that that what Crewe is having to say about it, that the president would not want to run up against Congress again on something as bald-faced as this, and that's what it is.
I just don't
assuming that there would be a run-up.
Thank you. I just don't know that he would gets pushback. I mean,
I think you're right. I mean, there's nothing, you can't know that he would get pushback. But the more these things do have a cumulative effect. They had them on Nixon in a malignant way. They had them on Carter in a benign way. So the way that these things, if you keep presenting Congress with things that they are just against and you get people in your own party starting to become against them, then you run into it. It's probably not going to happen with Joe Roth and Vornado, or Steve Roth and Vornado. But if they're the kind of things that add on to the sort of the, what is the game where you put Jenga pile? Yeah. I think that's problematic. But this is problematic on another level because you're going to be in court again on something like this. And they don't care. Obviously, they don't care. They're there to get their cronies wealthy. Yeah. And that's going to work. They're wealthy cronies wealthy, by the way. Right. People are already wealthy. Yeah, wealthy.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, look, we were just talking about the possible $800 billion that's going to be just given out to all these different contractors. I mean, that's obviously a much larger sum of money. But there's something personal about this, about that he can simply say, oh, my buddy gets this, that I think for a lot of Americans is going to be more clearly corrupt. Like everybody gets when your friend gets $2 billion. I mean, not that we have the personal experience, but we know that that sounds like Russia. It sounds like Turkey. It sounds like some third world country that we don't want to be. And I hope that a lot of Americans have a problem with this.
But John, I want to play off of what you just said. I know there's another thing you want to say, but what you said is so true. I mean, that's exactly what's going on here. And that's exactly what's at the center of this Russia investigation, right? It's people thinking, perhaps rightfully, we don't know yet, Bob Mueller hopefully is going to figure this out, that the reason that all of this is happening was to get his cronies richer. That he was going to lift these sanctions. In exchange for lifting these sanctions, wealthy Russians were going to come in, invest. They were going to relax the debt that they had. All of that was going to happen. So this is similar to that. I mean, this is exactly what's going on here. Let's get Steve Roth rich, just like we're going to get X, A, Y, and Z Russian rich.
Yeah, it's truly Putin-esque. I mean, it's absolutely what John said. I mean, it is. It's Russia 2.0.
Yeah. Now, just in case, like you think, okay, so this guy was on the stage with him. He called him a great builder. Okay, he's his friend. But I want to make really clear the business ties between these two as we close out this story. Vornado and the Trump Organization are jointly invested in two buildings already, one in Manhattan, one in San Francisco. Vornado is also in the midst of negotiations with Jared Kushner's corporation about the future of their 666 Fifth Avenue skyscraper. I love the. If you're a conspiracy theorist online, the fact that it's 666, that's just gotta just make you so tingly.
Yeah. When you were a little kid growing up in New York, there was a little cafe on the top called Top of the Sixes, which was like
was the
B version of Windows on the World at the World Trade Center. Or the
Interesting.
So it was a cheap way to get to the top of a building and have a piece of cake with your grandmother.
Now, we've talked about that building before, about how Jared Kushner invested a massive amount of money in this building as one of the first things that he did as like the head of this organization. Immediately prior to the Great Recession, by the way, which was a great call. But look at how clear the connection here is. The company, Vornado, came to the rescue of the Kushners when it agreed to an arrangement that gave Vornado 49.5% of the office portion of 666 and 70% of the retail space. So potentially saving billions of dollars for the Kushners there. And Kushner, of course, one of the chief advisors to Donald Trump. So whether it's Donald Trump's decision that this guy gets it, or if it's to help pay off the aid that they've given to the Kushners, I mean, that is sick in either case, and it's happening right now as we're filming this.
It's a Vornado shelter.
It's a Vornado shelter. How did they get so rich? I mean, look, those fans are not cheap, I'll grant you, but billionaires? Really? How complicated are those to build?
They're loss leaders, those fans. Yeah.
There you go.
Just bringing people in.
So we're going to take one more break in this first hour. You can tweet us at hashtag TYT Live what you think about these stories. Which bothers you more? The single case of $2 billion worth of corruption possibly for Vornado, or the countrywide corruption we're going to have in their infrastructure plan? Tweet us at hashtag TYT Live and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Young Turks, everybody. Mark and Michael and John. We've got two more stories we want to get to on some of Donald Trump's legal problems and their new strategy on how they're going to deal with the special counsel. But first, a few tweets. I'm a derpy panda says, wow, he's literally selling America piece by piece. Government should run like a business, right? And that's true. This is one of the things about the Trump presidency that we just all knew was going to come. It's just the massive looting of, again, it's another one of the things that he shares with so many third world dictators is it's for him and his family's personal enrichment. They take as much resources out, enrich their circle of friends. We had a big enough problem with the oligarchy before this.
Right. Of course, right, and righter. The only thing that surprises me is how naked the whole thing is. I mean, you know, right. Like it's the first thing, the chair's not even warm yet. And,
yeah, that's
and
true.
We're talking about this stuff.
That struck me most when he was sitting in Saudi Arabia at the first leg, on the first leg of that Middle Eastern trip. Well, actually, it's the only time he was in the Middle East, apparently, according to him, was when he was in Saudi Arabia. But when he was there, because they're the kings of it, but they are literally, that's what they do, is making each other rich, making the family rich, making the people that are close to the family rich. And he was there doing this deal and sort of making relationships with these people. And that's where I thought, my God, this is 120 days in and we're already here. Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It was fast. It was definitely fast. Let's see. One other tweet. The Forgotten Arm says, so private developers will toll the roads. Will they also be legally responsible for any failures from their construction work? I don't know. I would assume that they'll still be.
That's a point. and here, I checked off on that same thing. I think it's a really good point. One of two things will happen. Either the government, you and I, will indemnify them so that they, by taking this project, will not be responsible. But if there is a problem, will be responsible. Or there can be legal action, but it can be tied up in the courts for years and years and years. So that if somebody gets killed on a road that was built in a defective way, the family's not going to recover any money and the company's not going to be held to account for probably a very long time. But I think it's a really decent point.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing that, like, as much as I would hate any toll whatsoever, there's got to be examples of this. But the idea that sort of implicitly it has to go to a private corporation, like that theoretically it couldn't be set up so that it continues to generate money and benefit for that location or for the state or something like that. It's that obviously the road's got to help some rich dude. It's weird how our country
is set up. Yeah, that's bizarre. And by the way, and then we can move on. But, you know, contractors are hired to build roads and bridges in this country or to take on a certain project of one sort or another. They bid on it.
Yes.
There's competitive bidding, and then one is awarded the job. When it's done, it's done. If that's a toll road, those tolls are accrued to us. We make money as taxpayers on those.
So, yeah. Exactly. And automatically people are going to make money. I mean, to say that there's a difference is you know, why shouldn't people be making money? The people that win those bids do well. They hire people. And everything gets a bid. Where you buy the asphalt, who ships the asphalt, who lays the asphalt. I mean, there's so many different layers to it. If you give it just to whatever this guy's name is, Vornado, but that's a different, it's a different story.
Yeah.
But if you just give it to one of your friends and you privatize it everywhere, there's going to just be a small number of people that are making money.
Exactly.
And they're going to try and create the fewest jobs and try and keep their costs as low as they can so it all goes in their pockets.
Totally. Okay, let's turn to our last two stories, which I do think that we can get to. While Donald Trump and his minions were quick to claim that James Comey's testimony last week cleared him, that there's no story anymore, their comments since then about Bob Mueller's status as the special counsel indicate that they might well not be as confident as they're letting on. Newt Gingrich, who we know has an interesting relationship with Donald Trump, tweeted this. Republicans are delusional if they think the special counsel is going to be fair. Look who he is hiring. Check FEC reports. Time to rethink. Well, he's apparently been doing some rethinking because earlier he tweeted this. Bob Mueller is a superb choice to be special counsel. His reputation is impeccable for honesty and integrity. Media should now calm down. Newt, you might well want to calm down because as I tweeted earlier, things come at you fast on Twitter sometimes. Let's put those next to each other. I mean, we're basically talking about less than a month. You bring up this next one from a guy who is obviously has so much honesty and integrity that people cannot attack him to, dear God, get this guy out of here as quick as possible. I have a feeling Newt Gingrich was familiar with Mueller before the first tweet was sent. I don't think it was a new name to him necessarily. But he then went on, I believe on Sunday, he was on a radio show and he said this.
The key thing to me was that I think Congress should now intervene and should abolish the independent counsel, because Comey makes so clear that it's the poison fruit of a deliberate manipulation by the FBI director leaking to the New York Times to deliberately set up this particular situation. I think it's very sick.
Why does he matter, honestly? Why does he matter anymore?
His name comes up when positions are possible openings right. in the Trump administration. I'm not entirely sure. I don't know where he came from.
He opens his mouth and he's a compelling talking
exactly.
head.
Exactly. He's an articulate spokesman for the right, and he is showing up a lot in media. And in this environment, showing up a lot in media makes a difference. So I think really that is his universe.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sort of use him as a shorthand for Media Matters has a great compilation that they put out a day or two ago of this sort of talking point. There was Law News had an editorial over the weekend that obviously Mueller has to recuse himself on anything having to do with James Comey. And any number of right wingers on the radio or online are now pushing this idea that he is obviously flawed, he's obviously biased, both Comey but also Mueller. And I don't think that they would be saying that again. All this behavior from Donald Trump before the firing of Comey, how he's responded after the firing, and now the way his defenders are protecting him, this is not the behavior of people who believe there's nothing to be found, that think that if this investigation continued, there'd be no there. They're acting like people who are walking the plank and they're trying to talk their way out of it before they have to step off. That's what it seems like to me. Anyway, let's go to one more quick topic. So Donald Trump, because of the position that he holds that I won't name, has access to White House lawyers. It just comes with the job. And those are the sort of people who are experienced with the particular sort of investigation that he now finds himself the target of. They understand how to counsel people to protect themselves, to prepare for congressional testimony, or speaking to someone like the special counsel, Bob Mueller. They know how to act in that situation. And so obviously Donald Trump has no interest in using them, and he's decided to use his goofball lawyer instead. So this is Mark Kasowitz. Now, the New York Times reported on Sunday of this week that Kasowitz has told White House personnel that they will not need to obtain legal representation of their own and urge them not to speak to the media about the investigation into Trump and all of that related stuff. Now, when Comey was initially fired, let alone after his testimony, the dominant message that I heard from a lot of people was this is a time for people who work in the White House to get some sort of representation. That in the past, like when Bill Clinton was being investigated, that's what you do. And it seems odd that his personal lawyer would be telling them not to do that. That they should effectively like clam up, don't talk to the media. But other than that, just sort of hang tight. That seems odd to me. That seems like a strategy designed not to protect them, but to potentially leave them out to be investigated or attacked, and then maybe to thereby protect Trump. I'm not sure.
Well, I think a lawyer who looks at Donald Trump sees that every case he may have is undone by his talking, either mm-hmm. going on air, tweeting, writing in certain cases. I mean, I think that's part of it too. So I think a lot of that is why a personal lawyer would say that and advise mm-hmm. that to sort of try and, because Don McGahn is the White House counsel, and he's somebody who clearly doesn't think it's a bad idea to stop the tweeting because he's been on the Trump campaign, he's been in the Trump White House, he's been doing this now for quite a while, and he's got his own beat in that White House. But this guy comes in and he just has a client, and the client isn't the White House, the client's mm-hmm. the president. Or Trump. And so I think that there's probably, that's why he is trying to curb this, but I don't think that it matters at this point because it seems like so much has been said by this president that he's already, it's already dug in, which is why, the damage is done, which is why you're not seeing very much.
I think they're worried about contradictory things being said.
You know,
that's one of the things, as Michael says, when the president tweets and he tweets one thing, then he tweets a different thing. It happened on the Muslim ban and it continues to get them into trouble. And it goes on down the line. It's not just limited to the president. So when White House staffers start speaking and then contradicting themselves and they can't get their story straight, all of that can have a legal effect. By the way, this lawyer is the guy who settled that Trump University case for $25 million, which we were talking about on Friday.
Yeah, maybe that was a good deal for Trump, I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, and just to make clear that what you were saying, and a recent example of him shooting himself in the foot, Donald Trump, making it worse for himself by speaking in an attempt to defend himself, you have the tape situation that supposedly he has these recordings of James Comey. And he must have seen that as a good move to bring that up, but he's really put himself in a position where he's either going to be hurt by it or he's going to be hurt worse by it. If the tapes exist, my gut and everything I know about James Comey and Donald Trump tells me that they will back up James Comey's account of what was said. But we all know that it's unlikely that the tapes do exist. And if they don't exist, that's even worse for Donald Trump. Because if you're investigating obstruction of justice, how does it look if a president makes up recordings to try to get a potential witness in a court case to be quiet? I mean, that is intimidation beyond, I mean, it's fantastical at that point, and it's likely to be the case. Now, just two other quick points to give you an idea about Mark Kasowitz. It's an interesting game to play to try to find someone in the Trump administration that doesn't have some sort of weird connection to Russian oligarchs. We're still playing it because this is a case where we don't win. Kasowitz's other main clients include Sberbank, the largest state-owned bank in Russia, which was sanctioned by the Obama administration, and Oleg Deripaska, the Russian tycoon close to President Vladimir Putin, who has had business dealings with Paul Manafort. So that's who he's representing on the side. And by the way, to give you an idea about this guy, Mark Kasowitz, this is going to be the most shallow critique of Kasowitz you're going to hear today. But he's the guy that wrote this in response to Comey's testimony. It started, "I am Mark Kasowitz, President Trump's personal lawyer." Misspelled president in an official letter defending the Donald Trump against James Comey's testimony. Shallow, I know.
But it sounds like he'll fit right in with the crew that's making decisions.
He will. Anyway, I wish that we had more time, a lot more to talk to, including Donald Trump's absolutely laughable press conference from earlier today. But that's all the time we have. Thank you, Michael and Mark, for joining me.
And by the way, Sean Spicer's short. Is that what you were talking about?
I didn't actually see Sean Spicer in it.
They're getting shorter and shorter. There's less and less access
to
those press conferences. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's less and less access for the press to the White House.
I meant the like sort of self-congratulatory one.
I know
maybe we'll cover
that
some
was,
of it tomorrow.
No, I understand. Yeah, it should be covered. It should be lampooned.
Yeah. Now, right before we leave, if there's anything you'd like to plug, where can people see more of your work?
Well, you can hear Michael on my podcast, which is called The Edge. You can find it at edge-show.com, also on iTunes and places like that, and YouTube for that matter.
Yeah.
I was just told we're on YouTube, I didn't even know that. But Michael's there, and also a lot of other interesting conversations go down there too. Right. Edge-show.com.
And if you want to see more of Michael, there's a classic Curb Your Enthusiasm episode he's on.
Yeah, you won't recognize it. Or you can look for I-24 News. Have fun with that.
There you go. Okay, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I believe Hannah, my co-host from Think Tank, is going to be leading an awesome second hour. They've got some great stories, a lot of pride-related stories, some threats. Wait until you see the stats on the violence against the LGBT community over the past year. It is tragic.
And today is the 1 year anniversary of Orlando, the Pulse nightclub. So
exactly,
good stories to coincide with that.
Yep. So there will be coverage of that when we come back from this break.